Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
My fundamental reaction to the Banner Saga 3 is one of vindication. It turns out this was a journey worth taking, and a world worth keeping my heart for the last few years. In the end, it has justified its stylistic and narrative choices, and surpassed the hopes I had for it back when I played the first part of the trilogy. This final act may not offer a comfortable or easy resolution, but then again, that was never really in the cards. Like I said before, it's not that kind of story, and wishing it were otherwise only makes things worse.
That was, of course, Rob Zachney reading his own review of the Banner Saga 3, titled "The Final Act of the Banner Saga Cements Its Bleak Greatness." I'm Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 175. In addition to Rob, joining me today, of course, is Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
The True Gamer, and Austin Walker.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, everybody. So today, I figured for topic, since we had this lovely review by Rob, we would talk a bit about sort of final chapters in sagas of games, or sagas of games. I'm on a saga trip here with the Banner Saga, but sort of final.
Believe me, that was a real problem when I was writing
boy.
That review.
I'm sure you were like, and in this saga, at the end of my long saga.
Well, the entire point was like, I was like, oh, it truly became a saga, but how the fuck do you say that about a game called the Banner Saga?
You were waving your banner for the truest saga that you had gone through. Sojourn? Maybe we could do a Sojourn?
I should have gone Sojourn.
Taking it off from that, our experiences with games that are long-running series, or even if not long-running, series that actually attempt to have closure and attempt to actually tell a concrete, basically, story. So, Rob, it sounds like this one was one of very, very few for you that actually did it in the end, that actually closed off its story in something like a satisfying way, even if it wasn't necessarily a happy ending. And that is, it seems to me, quite rare in games, or at least in my experience it is.
Yeah, I think, but one of the reasons I think this works is because the Banner Saga 3, like, builds on and intensifies a series of games that has always been, like, bittersweet at best. Like, there is no unalloyed joy in the Banner Saga. Like, every time something good happens, it's probably because something bad just happened, or something bad is just around the corner. And so, by this third game, I think what's really impressive is it finishes strong by committing to what it's always been. And what, like, sort of stymied me in places was this expectation that, like, all right, here's the one where we start getting, like, you know, good endings, right? This is where, like, you know, the heroes really come into themselves and save the world and, you know, redeem
find
the
magic emerald
in a lot
that
of
fixes
ways.
Everything.
Yeah, or just, like, make the grand heroic gesture. Like, it wasn't even I was looking for, like, Deus Ex Machina, but it was more like,
sure,
go full paladin, right? And, like, the game would somehow reward me. But that's not what the Banner Saga is. And so it started smacking me around, basically, every time I started playing that way. But that felt good because it was true to itself. It was like, this is truly the finale that the Banner Saga should have.
Right.
And I think that's an interesting part here, is that it may not have given you exactly, like, what you wanted in like, sort of a confectionery sense, where I want sort of a sweet, soothing ending. But it gave me what I wanted from a Banner Saga game.
And what do you want from a Banner Saga?
Which is, tell me that one.
What do I want from a Banner Saga game?
Yeah.
I think I want exactly that. I want this complicated exploration of, like, what is heroic virtue in, it's not the real world, but, like, the motivations are very realistic. Like, the characters are very grounded. Weights of history do not vanish overnight. Like, I'll give you a small spoiler here. And it's just, there's a moment you can have where you can piss off all your giant allies. There's this race called the Varl. They're giants. There are going to be no more of them in the world. They're created by, the gods themselves. And, sure. like, they sprang into existence with the existence of the world. There will never be any more than there are right now. And so their numbers just dwindle through the years. And there is this moment that you can really piss them off by basically trying to just, like, give them tough love and, like, tell them, like, keep your eye on the big picture right. and not at all listen to what they're trying to say about, like, how they're feeling about their place in history and this knowledge of, like, their own looming extinction. And I sort of did the, like, damn it, no. We just have to, you know, for the good of all peoples, for the good of existence, you know, just get with the goddamn program. And the reaction to that was like, you know what? You, like, for all our travels together, you yeah. still don't get it.
Yeah.
Fuck you. And they left. And that was, like, that was bad. It was real bad.
You just load a save at that point? Because that seems like a big one, to just lose all of your giants.
Well, I kept thinking they'd come back. Like, I was like, oh, clever. Clever game. Almost got me, but I'm sure they'll reconcile in, like, 5 minutes. No.
Not so much.
But, like, that's kind of what I wanted, is that you're never going to have that moment of the elves showing up at Helm's Deep.
Right.
And it's like, all right, it's cool. Everyone's got to think about the greater good here, and the past is the past. Even on the edge of, like, extinction, you know, the past isn't even past.
It's still the
past
in the Banner Saga. Totally. So, I mean, one of the things that I'm curious about is, like, the thing that you kind of put together in that review is that, hey, this is totally in line with what the Banner Saga has always been. And I guess I'm still kind of curious, not even about your preference about this specific game, which it sounds like you think still hits the notes right, but is this a situation where the police are outside my house and they have thoughts about the Banner Saga? No, there's, like, there's an ambulance. It's a whole thing. Anyway, I'm curious if, for you in general, when you think about the conclusions of series, of, like, hey, this is the third or fourth game in a franchise, they're wrapping up the main story, Do you want the developers to stick the landing and create what was so magical about the rest of the series for you, or do you want them to offer something different, which is often a sense of closure or a different perspective on the events that have happened so far or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, my answer that's sort of a cheat here is, like, I want the ending that's worthy of the story they've been telling, that's worthy of the themes they've been building out. And I think one of the tensions I had in the Banner Saga is I wanted also, in addition to that, a character that would be rewarding for the an ending that would be rewarding for the characters. Uh-huh. You know, like, okay, enough bad things have happened to, you know, the stars of this lineup. Let's give them their happy ending. I also want that, but not really. Like, in the end, I want the delivery on the themes and the story we've been telling throughout. And that's where the Banner Saga succeeds. But I think, you know, to throw out, like, an example of a game that maybe doesn't stick that landing, a game where this tension isn't resolved, something that always struck me about, like, the reaction to Mass Effect 3, it always seemed to me that, like, that series had always set this expectation of, like, end of the day, y'all are getting out of this alive.
Right.
And it's, you know, let's have beers aboard the Normandy and continue hanging out together in space. Mm-hmm. And there, I think there was this tension of, well, I want this good ending for my characters, but I also want it to wrap up the larger overarching story you've been telling. And I think there was a discontinuity in the trajectory the characters have been taking through each game, and then the trajectory the you know, a plot of the entire series was taken.
Did you play it before or after the happier ending was sort of patched in, I guess?
Oh, I played it ages later, well after the patch came out.
Did you, how about this one? Because there's like multiple ways to think about this. Did you play it before or after, with or without the Citadel DLC? Which
also, like, didn't get the Citadel DLC.
Wait, okay, so is that the funny thing? Was it the Leviathan? The Leviathan?
the Leviathan DLC offered a lot more perspective on, like, the history of the Reapers.
Not just history, like, essentially, like, filled in, like, massive plot holes, like, yep. The story never addressed.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
I remember at Giant Bomb, when we were debating Game of the Year, there was this divide where none of us were happy with Mass Effect 3 except for Brad Shoemaker, because he's the only one that played it after all the DLC was out.
Oh.
And his perspective on the story was so radically different, because, like, nah, all this shit's explained. And for us, it was like, well, yeah, but in a DLC that came out months after the game and did not make it, it was not a satisfying part of the narrative, because it's like, oh, I'll go back before the ending and then go fill in these gaps. You know, it was a strange thing.
Which is like, but also his experience of playing that game was valid, because that was the version he had. Like, he couldn't have played it
more
in a different
way.
More
votes on our side, though, so fuck him.
Yeah, of course, of course. Well, so, but the one that's more interesting to me is the Citadel one, because that gives you the end of, like, the rising, jumping, like, yeah, we're all in it together.
Because it's long enough that so I think people, the Leviathan was a, like,
6 years ago.
Lore heavy, go down into the water and explain so much of history.
Find out who existed before the Reapers were built,
like,
and what happened
there. Sort of like
there.
If there was, like, for people that didn't like Lost, if there was an episode that's like, yo, I'm just going to sit in front of this camera and I'm going to explain 15 questions to you.
Right.
Like, that's what that DLC
here are your
did.
Core, you know, important story beats that had not been explored previously. The Citadel DLC was, like, the opposite of that, which is, like, super fan servicey, return to the Citadel, get up to some hijinks with your old buddies, and then wrap it up with a cool party at the bar, and everyone gets drunk, and, like, you kind of have your big final blowout party before the final confrontation with the Reapers and everything that happens at the end of that game. And a lot of people loved that because it gave them the thing. Like, it fulfilled that need that the base game did not. The base game goes into that finale with, like, a conversation with all of your party members and all of your past party members on the way to the whatever the final run. You know, you get into your Mako or whatever the fuck it was and go down that hill. But before that, it's like, all right, I'm going to check in with Garrus. I'm going to check in with Liara and have, like, the mind meld one more time. I'm going to, you know, see all the Krogans together, you know, lined up. And I've dealt with their shit with the Salarians, so they're cool now. And, like, it was just like, okay, this is kind of rote and checkboxy, but with the Citadel DLC, I think a lot of people were able to get that final resolution, or not the resolution, they were able to get that, like, alternate universe, what if all these characters are just super happy, and then the ending that we didn't like just didn't happen. Well, this is the end of the game. We fucking got there, we had a dope party, the end. And I appreciate it for the fan service stuff, but it never really set super well with me, because it did feel out of tone for the rest of that game, which was about, like, characters you know dying, and the, you know, the relationships that you had pushed to their brinks finally falling apart. And so I think that's one of the things with Mass Effect 3 in general, is it pulled triggers that it sort of set up in Mass Effect 1 and 2, and forced you to make really, really hard final choices about the relationship between the Quarians and the Geth, between the relationship between the Salarians and the Krogans, and all that stuff. And sometimes it wasn't satisfying to pull a trigger.
Yeah.
Like, you almost wanted the resolution to be deferred because you liked the status quo, which was, I know what this universe is. And sometimes because they just didn't stick the landing super well.
Or wanted it to be messy in some way. As opposed to, like,
exactly.
This happened, it is done now. Now it's all wrapped up.
Is that your Morden?
It is done now.
Solace?
He sang a song. It was sad.
She sang a song. You know, it was sad. It's a sad moment.
I have a weird relationship with Mass Effect 3, while we're still on Mass Effect 3, I suppose.
Please.
In that I hadn't touched it. You know, I beat the base game back in 2012 before any of the DLC, before any of the anything, and I haven't touched it since. So my complete experience with that was just the base game. And hearing about Citadel being a fun party and being like, that sounds nice, but, you know, I was more or less fine with how it ended. I did the synthesis thing. It was, everybody was green. It was fine. But I had a weird relationship with that series because, on one hand, it got more gay as the series went on. Like, 1, 2, and 3, like, became increasingly queer, and that was awesome. But the games themselves, story-wise, became somewhat less interesting as it went on. So it was like, there was, like, a bizarre XY correlation between the queerness, or, like, the romance options that you could take, and
sure.
how sort of straightforward the storytelling became. Because that first game is just that amazing, brimming with possibilities, ridiculous sci-fi stuff, incredible world building, janky as hell gameplay. And two is, I think a lot of people feel, has sort of a sweet spot gameplay-wise, but unless you romance Liara as a lady, there wasn't, you know... Which I did,
right.
of course, in one of my many, many playthroughs of it. But at the end of the third game, it was finally like, oh, it's 2012 now. It's okay to have gay characters. There was a gay dude, and there was a woman that was, like, only romanceable to lady players. And it was like, oh, you've gotten there. But now the game is somewhat less interesting in other ways. And that was a bizarre thing. I guess a weird...
Right, there's, like, an inversion there, yeah. right? Which is also... Rob, you have a thing. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, to me, like, the analogy is the Banner Saga, and, like, I think originally the Banner Saga might even have been conceived as one game.
Mm.
Like, Stoic did a series of Kickstarters, and I did a preview on this game ages ago for PC Gamer, back when this idea was first being pitched. And I think basically it was, like, look, this is how we can get across the finish line. But, like, the way it's conceived, it's kind of one story, and that entire story takes place in what would be, like, the final half of Mass Effect 3, basically, right? Like, that now the world-defining calamity is here, and the story begins there. And it's all these characters that we meet in the middle of this process and coming to terms with the scope of what is happening. The Mass Effect series is largely a game about... It's about hanging out with friends, like resolving their personal issues. It's about being a good servant of a militarized bureaucracy.
You love it. Yeah, that's it.
In a lot of ways.
Gotta be one.
That's, yeah. And so I think what's weird in the third game is that, you know, the way it opens is very much like the world's changed forever. Like, literally, Shepard starts having these visions. The entire game is screaming, like, your characters are almost... They're already in sort of this twilight land between, like, mortality and death, right? Like, they've already passed beyond that, or at least Shepard has. And so now the game tries to turn around and say, like, but it's still Mass Effect, so you can still, like, have relationships and, you know, hang out with your crew and go on adventures. But at this point, like... there's this massive tension between, like, what Mass Effect has always been, which is, like, characters acting as if the world is going to go on. There's going to be a tomorrow. And then Mass Effect 3, you know, the stakes are very high. The time frame is getting very compressed. And they try to have it both ways. And I think like, even as someone who played those games, I also wanted it both ways. But mm-hmm. there's no way that's going to really... tie together or be, like, thematically satisfying.
I think that's the biggest thing. Do you want to be happy or do you want to be satisfied with a lot of this, right? In how you feel about how things have wrapped up or how series have wrapped up. And I know there's another... I feel like we're talking about a lot of threes in series, but I suppose it makes sense. I know, Austin, in sort of chatting about this, you had mentioned Dark Souls 3 and how you felt about how that sort of wrapped up, which I feel like is a bizarre parallel to Mass Effect 3. In a lot of ways, in which the way fans kind of talk about it in certain ways, but it also kind of remixes elements a little bit or sort of like rearranges elements in some interesting ways. And again, I only played 3, so...
Right. Well, it's such a different thing because you're not carrying the same character through your Dark Souls experience. And because instead there's a sort of like there's a kind of a meta narrative happening, which is Dark Souls says, hey, here is the way the world is. There is a fire and that's what keeps everyone alive. You have a choice as you investigate this fire and fight a bunch of skeletons and gargoyles and other shit.
Alive might be relative in that.
Yeah, alive is right.
After a while. Yeah.
For a while, the fire kept everybody alive. Uh-huh. The fire is dimming. People are a thing not quite alive anymore. And the only way to keep living is to relight that fucking fire or to let it fade into darkness and move into a new age and the age of shadow. And then the second game is like, okay, that happened. At some point distant in the future, you know, where things have, this cycle has repeated again and again and again with some variation. And the second game's whole thing is just like, hey, there will always to some degree be the scholar who pushes too far and performs, you know, inhuman experiments. And there will always be the greedy king who, you know, builds a castle on the backs of slaves. There will always be this, you know, like that is the sort of like, here are the Jordan Peterson, like, or Hero with a Thousand Faces, if we want to get like less terrible about it. There are the kind of Jungian archetypes. There are these archetypes in this world, in the world of Dark Souls, and they do recur, but sometimes they recur slightly differently, and so the larger story can come and change over a long, long, long period of time. And so going to the third one, it's like, well, okay, we know that there's been the setup of like, here is what the fiction of the world is. You know that there is this idea of repetition and repeatability and kind of a kind of a cycle. So what's the third one going to bring to it? And the thing that it ends up trying to do is both be the sequel that Dark Souls 2 was not by literally returning you to familiar places like Anor-Londo, and you know, having actual specific characters show back up. Not just echoes of those characters, not just someone with a similar name and like the armor is the same, but looking at like some of the bosses where it's like, oh no, that is just this person. Like that is just this person, you know, that has been hurt or has been captured by this other person or whatever. And that game ends up having to do something very difficult, which is in a game about an unbreaking cycle, in a game in which, you know, historically the game series has been like, oh, there's no way out of this. This is like the thing of going to the fucking Age of Shadows. We're going to come back here eventually. At some point, we're going to be back at this moment. That game has to say, no. This time, this is it. This is the end of it. And the way that I think it does it the best is each of the bosses in that game is effectively a different player character. The bosses in Dark Souls 3 are all former, like, they're all chosen ones also, basically, who failed to do the job. And so all of the level design, all of the boss design, all of the, like, the lore bits you're picking up are basically about other moments in this cycle and the ways in which these characters decided in their last moment, you know what, fuck it, I'm actually not going to go through with this bullshit. I'm not going to sacrifice myself to keep everybody alive. And that ends up being a really interesting focal point for thinking through some of those big themes, and also just mechanically speaking, returning to a lot of similar boss fight mechanics, a lot of like sorts of spaces where you go through them and you get the sense of deja vu that could only happen in the third game, or the, you know, in a further game in the series. And for me, it basically did it the right way, which is to say, I left it going like, all right, I don't need a Dark Souls 4. I don't need a Dark Souls 4. There are parts where I didn't need a Dark Souls 3, but by and large, I got through that game and really liked it. And came out of it the other side feeling like, all right, this felt like a natural conclusion. I felt like that the narrative space has been explored. And that's part of why I'm so excited to see Sekiro, because, like, I'm glad we're not just getting another Dark Souls game. I want to see them continue to play with mechanics and with storytelling device stuff. So that is my Dark Souls 3 spiel.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what you're touching on is that, so like in other forms of storytelling, like books and movies, there's story and then there's characters, right? And
right.
I mean, we can get a difference between like plot and story. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole but let's just say like there's plot and then there's characters. Yeah. And we'll just like make those two buckets. And often, like, you can be attracted to a story for like the plot or the premise. And then you get drawn in by the characters, and then the plot is just like, it's just a reason, you know, for the characters to go through different things, and you're there for that. And in games, like, you have this additional layer of mechanics, which ties into then plot/premise and characters. And I think that's where a lot of games get into trouble, is where they're trying to balance between these three buckets, in which are you maybe you're not even here. Like, for me, I could not give less of a shit about the plot or the characters of the Souls games. Like, I'm here for the mechanics. Now, yes, they tie in thematically, and there's reasons their designers are thinking that stuff through, but, like, I don't care. And I think lots of games run into this. Like, look at, like, BioShock, I think, is a great example of a game in which it's
Elon
final
Musk's
moment.
Favorite
Elon
game.
Elon Musk's favorite game about submarines. Yeah. Yep.
Uh-huh.
Right, so like that game has a final boss that's like deeply unsatisfying because it's trying to play into a trope about the mechanical build of how games are traditionally made, and that, like, oh, you're supposed to go up against a final boss that is a culmination of, quote-unquote, everything you've learned while you've played this game. But what that final boss does is, like,
betray, like, narrative stuff that's happening and the crescendos that's happening in that game. Like, whatever you think of what happens in Bioshock, like, the way they structure this final boss, like, betrays it because there's this thought that, oh, mechanically, this is what you're supposed to do to satisfy the player on this mechanical level. And so it's interesting to watch different games approach that in different ways and the different value sets they put on. Where, like, do the plot and the characters only exist in service of the mechanics? Do the characters exist in service? They switch that and the characters are in service of the mechanics? And I think games balance that in different ways, and they get lost when, like Mass Effect, like part of the reason the Citadel was appealing was because, I mean, yes, I guess you could argue it's a status quo thing, but I would actually argue it had more to do with character resolution for people, like that the Citadel allowed them to get a character resolution for the story because either the plot resolution wasn't particularly good, which is often the case. Most stories get worse. Like, most stories don't get better as they go along. Like, we are often attracted to the premises of things, and then as they go through the motions, as they try and find a way to end, well, we discover that, like, they probably only came up with the beginning and didn't have a satisfying end. Because endings are hard. Like, endings are really, really difficult to do. I think that's why the Citadel was attractive, because, like, oh, I get this character resolution because the plot resolution was not very satisfying. And maybe what that reveals is actually this game was about characters and not about plot, and that by the third one they got really obsessed with the plot and they lost the thread a little bit on the characters. And I think a lot of stories do that. That's why I like the ending of Lost. I think Lost ends very well for the characters, and I think you can make lots of credible arguments for why the plot doesn't end particularly
well. Doesn't work so well.
Yeah.
The other thing that games do here, and, like, focusing back in on this notion of mechanics, three things, really, but the two that I want to hit first are, one, sometimes the mechanics will change over the course of a game to reflect changes in taste, both the taste of the developers and the taste of the audience. And that can be really tough because sometimes the audience really wants that first experience again, right? I think about something, the BioWare games, again, are really good for this, looking at how Mass Effect moves from being this kind of, this game about exploring these planets in Mass Effect 1 and scrolling through text boxes and more, like, shooting your way through prefab locations, but mostly just kind of repeating that cycle in a game where shooting is a thing you do, but, like, it does not feel particularly good. And then Mass Effect 2, it starts to feel really good because it's kind of biting third-person action games at the time. But even looking at something like, or even more so looking at something like Dragon Age, which goes from being something that you could totally play from this isometric, top-down, like, old-school computer RPG style in Dragon Age Origins, to specifically the jump to Dragon Age 2, which ends up having this kind of, I don't want to say button mashy, but it's an action feeling combat with some cooldowns and stuff, really, like, pushed some players away, which is a shame because I actually think that in terms of what the focus of that game's story is and the way that those characters are portrayed and the tone of the writing in the game, that switch actually makes a lot of sense. But a game is for a company like BioWare and for a publisher like EA, is a product, and so the reaction ends up being about how the product has changed and failed to, like, reach the what people liked about the first one. And that can be really, really tough. And then the second thing there is the second part of this, like, their products thing, which is sometimes you don't even fucking know if you're going to get a conclusion, or a game can be a conclusion, but, like, is it really? When are we going to get The Witcher 4? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? Because we're going to get a fourth Witcher game. And then also, obviously, just, like, inside of that, sometimes a developer will have to say, like, okay, this is going to close the chapter for our development house. But then another developer will come in and reopen the book. And that makes so many things, or just one developer will have to end a book that somebody else started. And all of those material, like, constraints and pressures on the development of video games means that they're so much different than, like, if I sat down to write a book trilogy, what that final book looks like would be different on the day I finished writing it than on the day I started writing the first one. But games are even way more wild than that, even.
The Witcher is an interesting example because as much as people want another Witcher, The Witcher 3's ending, and especially the epilogue that comes from the Blood and Wine DLC, is far and away one of the most satisfying conclusions. Like, it ties up every bow in a way that doesn't feel checklisty. It's just, you end with those characters and go, I mean, okay, yeah, I guess if they made another one, like, all right, like,
I guess I'd revisit these characters, but you don't. It's like, it's very difficult to end a story where you feel like, cool, like I'm done with this world. Like, I'd like to come back to this world, but I don't need to revisit these characters. And I, like, if you played The Witcher 3 and didn't play the Blood and Wine DLC, I think Witcher 3 ends like really well on its own. But the Blood and Wine DLC, with some of the, I guess, epilogue-y stuff, I would say, for lack of a better term, like is incredibly satisfying, where that world just ends in a way that, and not in like a, it blows up, but just in a way that's like, cool, like you, this doesn't happen. Part of the reason it feels special is because it's like a great set of characters that find themselves to a natural finish line. But also, like, you look around and go, oh, right, like 99% of stories don't find a way to do this. Like, most stories, whether they plan to or not, don't end up finding their way to a conclusion that feels like, ah, like this is where the characters were supposed to go. And The Witcher 3 absolutely is like this rare exception where I came to the end of it was just like so deeply satisfied about where they found a resolution for everyone in the story.
One day I'll beat it. I put like 110 hours into that game and I still haven't actually beat it.
I skipped the whole last area basically and just said,
oh, wow.
Monster contracts.
I mean, I didn't skip all of it, but like I got to the last like major area and was just like, I don't have another 60 hours. Not in me. It was just like, I don't have another 60 hours. And so I just like rushed to the, and like, but I did everything in the two DLCs. Oh, they're so good. The DLC to that game is just, DLC is underselling it. Expansion is a better word because they're like, they're like 20 to 30 hours each.
Oh, yeah. Actually, though, I want to ask you a little bit about this. I also am not quite finished with The Witcher 3. I'm hunting some kind of swamp thing, and I just had that moment where I'm like, I can't.
Right.
I can't do this right now. I'll come back next week. And that was like 3 years ago. Anyway, point is, the entire structure, though, the game is already this like fantasy epic that wraps up this trilogy that's all been huge. Then there's an epilogue. I'm curious, like, what, like, why does that epilogue work so well? Because the game has to have its own conclusion that's satisfying. Why does that epilogue for you, like, sort of see off the series and provide, like, a, bring that entire thing to a period?
Because it's, well, one, the DLC is not really pitched as an epilogue. There's just some stuff that, like, ends up tying into the main story. I think Witcher 3 ends perfectly fine. The reason it works so well is because it provides, it adds to the story in a way that you didn't think you needed. So like that's like, it's not that it's plugging in like, gee, I wonder what happened sort of stuff. It's more just they add a layer to the story in a way that, like I said, like that you didn't feel like you needed. Like it's less satisfying. Like that's why like the Leviathan stuff with Mass Effect was like really frustrating because it's like, I did want that. And the game didn't provide it. And then later, it just plugged it in. And it's a different feeling if you go through that game and it's just there from the beginning because you're not experiencing it in the order that it was, like, released. Like, that's just a different sort of narrative experience. But with The Witcher 3, like, its main story ends completely fine. Like, deeply satisfying in the main story. And just some of the stuff they add through the DLC makes you just go, oh, ah. Like, it's masterfully done in a way that doesn't undercut. And also does not, it doesn't, it's not necessary is what I'd say. All it does is add texture to a story that already ended well in a way that you can appreciate, but did not, is not necessarily required reading for you to come out of The Witcher 3 happy and content.
I mean, that was the sort of the thing that ended up happening with me in Mass Effect 3, is that when I beat that game, I didn't necessarily need more. Like, I was happy with that conclusion, largely because I had made peace with those characters through their individual arcs in the game, and I almost didn't want to belabor it anymore. And I think maybe that's just because I was playing that character, the version of Shepard I was playing was like, you know, the last thing I want is to hang out with people. And honestly, I don't care about the fish that came before the Reapers. So reading the information was cool. Like, I enjoyed getting the information. I didn't ever go back and play the Leviathan. I watched those that DLC.
Yep,
obviously. I left that with those feelings. I did feel satisfied. And that ends up being a really difficult and weird thing because you end up having, like, it's a hard conversation to have. When someone is like, I didn't like how this thing ended. And you're like, I did. Like, there's no, that's, you're at cross paths. Like, I'm never going to convince someone that they did, that they had a good time with Mass Effect 3. They didn't. Like, I shouldn't have to feel defensive about my own experience.
It's more than packing why, like, right? Like, that's when, yes, I talk about, like, the difference exactly between, it, like, character resolution, yes, and plot resolution, and seeing people's reactions to things like, mm-hmm, the Citadel and the Leviathan DLC, right? Because, like, those are fulfilling different needs that people bring to a story. Right. And in the same way that we talk about, like, you know, the classic example, people say, like, oh, the shotgun's overpowered. It's like, well, actually, like, the pistol is underpowered, right? Like, that's how game balance works. Like, because, right, people have a difficult time articulating how they feel about a thing, and they express that in the bluntest way possible. And I think that's also true for, like, storytelling, right? Like, you can say, like, oh, I didn't feel fulfilled because of X, but it actually may turn out it's because of Y, and you just didn't realize that. Now, then that's not to say, had they filled in that gap, that suddenly you'd be satisfied. Maybe you wouldn't. But I think, you know, the reaction to Mass Effect 3's ending and all sorts of other endings, you know, I think the reasons people aren't satisfied, they may not necessarily even be able to articulate, because, right, that stuff both requires, like, a thorough understanding of, like, how narrative work, and then also, because, you shouldn't necessarily need to, like, if the game doesn't satisfy you, the game doesn't satisfy you, right? Like,
right,
just because
100%.
Just because you can't pull apart where things didn't work is not your fault. That's, you know, that's the game's fault, or the storytelling to a large degree. But I think sometimes, like, it is worth trying to understand why something was dissatisfying, even if that doesn't necessarily allow you to fix it or address it. And that was the weird part about the whole BioWare situation, or Mass Effect situation, was because it was one of the rare instances where they said, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay, like, how can we fix this? Which I was never a fan of. Like, I like, if you thought you made a mistake, stick by the mistake, I guess.
Right, and, like, unless they stumbled into that conclusion somehow, which I cannot imagine. If you work in a creative field, whether that is writing music or writing fiction or writing journalism, right? Like, whatever that is, making a painting, the decision to end something, like, all right, this is done, is always a subjective one. There is never a meter that finishes. You're like, oh, that's it. I did it. It's done 100%. I can stop editing this now. I can stop adding to this. I can stop trying to trim it. It's always a, like, to some degree, arbitrary decision. You can always edit one sentence more or you know, write one more sentence, or remove one more, right? That's always a thing you can do. But my understanding of game development is such that they knew what the end of that game was for a long time before it went fucking gold. And I cannot imagine a world in which internally they were like, this is a thing I'm fully not happy with as it is, without having already, you know, address that early on in production. And so I definitely am of the mind of just like, listen, y'all shipped this thing, stand by the work, stand by your writing team. Like, I don't know, maybe Rob, you just raised your hand, you may have some differences there.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
No, I was wondering if just the nature of video games also makes endings more fraught, because, you know, we identify with the avatar a little more. We inhabit the characters, the world a little bit more. Like, is it, let's let me put this, is it easier to be a passenger on a show? You're just you're a spectator, right, to, you know, how are things going to end for Tony Soprano? People ask this for years. People still discuss it. You know, how did things turn out for Tony Soprano? But the point is, at no point are you Tony.
Right.
Right? Like, unless you're a real dumbass who's like, yeah, Tony's fucking awesome.
That's me. I'm like, Tony Soprano over here. Hey.
Yeah. But, you know, unless you're, you know, that kind of point-missing asshole... in
it's
general,
my uncle,
like,
by the way. That's the person you described.
Excuse me. My uncle,
sorry,
Tony.
I'm sure he's awesome.
Yeah. That fucking, he chased the Russian into the fucking woods. That was me. I did that. That was me.
Too.
Like, all right, thanks. Great.
But, you know, you watch that show, and you're never in control of it, and you get used to, like, the ways that universe works and the painful decisions characters make and the bad ways things turn out. And it's a little different in games because, in general, this is a medium about, like, you know, if you play well, if you make the right calls, you know, you'll beat the game, you'll win in the end. And a lot of times, like, even in a branching narrative game, there's a good ending.
Right.
Like, go back and maybe make some different choices, and you'll get there eventually.
You didn't get the drop on level 6. You have to get that good drop, and that'll open up the true ending.
Right, and does that make it a little more fraught
right.
to do that thing which a creator has to do, which is to say, like, look, this is the ending of the story. This is how this thing is winding down. When your audience has a completely different relationship to the thing than in any other medium.
And that's when the Animorphs author can come in and write a letter that's like, you didn't fucking get it. That's your problem, idiot.
God, yeah. People should go back and listen to that episode of Hot Mic Mornings that we released on the feed, because in that episode we talked about this amazing letter that Kay Applegate wrote about the end of the Animorphs book series. Patrick's eyes are all the way wide. Like, the end of that book series goes some dark places in terms of, like, fighting genocidal aliens and people, like, kids dying in war.
It's about war.
So of course. Everything ends that
that's,
way.
That's why I read that series.
Yeah. Is that... Yeah, of course. And so after she released the final book, people were like, hey, this is dark. Why is this couple split apart forever? Why did this kid die? Why is this one, like, wounded forever, like, endlessly tormented by the decision he made in war? And so she wrote this, like, response. It was like, yeah, dog, that's war. War is terrible. And, like, it ends with this amazing call to voting action where it's like, hey, when you're old enough, you're going to be able to vote for the people who decide to put other young people into war or not. Like, maybe carry some of these lessons forward about the fact that even when wars are necessary, even when you've decided this is worth it, it's worth killing people over this, there is always a cost. And then shout outs to Kay Applegate for that very good letter.
Beautiful mic drop. She's
fantastic. The thing that I actually wanted to say there, though, is, like, I definitely, Rob, that perspective definitely does make me think about it differently. I was literally this morning, so it is Friends of the Table finale season. We're finishing up a big science fantasy season right now. Those episodes come out over the next few weeks. And in order to produce those episodes, my producer needs more time. And so I did a fill-in episode this week where I just, like, wrote 30 minutes of fiction and read that into a microphone. And one of the responses was like, it was about the creation of a machine that can see the future and the way in which the society that built that machine used it to build kind of a military dominance. And in it, in response to it, I had a fan who was like, hey, actually, this makes me rethink about a character from a previous season. I wonder if they helped with building this terrible machine that could predict the future and hurt people. And my immediate reaction was like, no, I would never do that to that player. That player would have had to have collaborated with me to decide that they wanted to become a villain if that's the thing that they wanted to do. And so suddenly I totally do get that point that you're making, Rob, which is, like, as a creator who also has a player, I do genuinely think that I have a responsibility to think about the desires of the players and to think especially about the kind of no-go zones, the places in which I have decided to defer and let their agency carry forward. That said, I think video games are a lot different than tabletop games, where my tabletop game player could say, like, no, my character would, like, leave forever and get in a spaceship and go to a different planet before ever helping with that and run, you know, be on the run for the rest of his life. Whereas in Mass Effect, there's a limited number of options, and you as the writing staff have the ability to shape that. And I think it's about making informed choices around what those options can actually look like, so that you think you are at the very least reflecting the spectrum of desires by that your players might have.
I think there's...
Well, that's what the... Go ahead. Go ahead. No,
you're Danielle, you
all
have
right.
a thing.
The only thing I was going to say was there's also the issue of marketing here and the way that fans treat something. And the way, obviously, when we're talking about Mass Effect 3, the way that went down wasn't awesome. I mean, in 2012, we still thought it was really shocking when there was a hate campaign. towards the creators of a game, which, imagine that, right? Like, that was, it was eye-opening and shocking when that, happened.
Was that really 2012? That was 2012,
6 years
huh?
ago, right? Like, feels like 26 years ago. But in a lot of ways, the video game industry, and there's a lot of stuff around this, of course, but the industry has absolutely played into that, oh, empower the players. Now you're playing with power. Mm-hmm. Like, actually, oh, yes, you should be empowered. You should be empowered, which speaks directly to what you were saying earlier, Rob, about, you know, if there's a major difference between a lot of other pieces of fiction or types of fiction and games, because this audience has specifically been told through marketing for 30 odd years, more than 30 years, I suppose, at this point, almost 40 years, that, like, you're in control. And that's like a, that's a selling point, which I think feeds really directly into that, into some of these feelings and into some of that tension, into how it's so hard for creators now to actually say, like, no, I'm putting my foot down. At K.A. Applegate, you know, like, put it out there, right? This is about war. And instead kind of make the happy ending or make the sort of fan fiction or fan-friendly ending or pieces around the ending like that. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, I think that's, you know, Mass Effect, I think part of the criticism of that ending was, like, you know, they sold, infinite choices equals infinite outcomes. And, you know, as it turns out, like, funnels into... like three, maybe it was a four by the time they patched
three.
It.
It's three.
Three at the beginning.
No, it's three. Yeah. It's three.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, regardless. You know, in part of, I think the mistake they made was, it was probably they had much grander ambitions early on, and then, you know, realized as they hit to the conclusion, like, oh, actually, like, we have to start funneling these choices in a way, like, we want to, you know, as you mentioned, Danielle, like, empower the player, like, really engage with their choices and have consequences. And that absolutely happens throughout the series. But in the ending, it all kind of funnels into, like, it's part of the presentation, right? It's like the presentation of three glowing icons for, like, that represent, like, a multitude, you know, a handful of really big decisions, like, you know, dozens of medium decisions, and, you know, hundreds or thousands of, like, minor decisions, like, that just funnel into three glowing orbs, or three glowing buttons, as it may be. Like, I think I like, you know, specifically the first season of The Walking Dead from Telltale Games, like, I think is the Telltale Games at their best, are a tremendous example of, like, misdirection, in which they present as games that are about player choice, when really, like, players are only making choices on the margins, and you're all being funneled into a very similar ending, and yet you feel enormous authorship over what happens along the way. I mean, you're still deciding characters who live and die, but ultimately the plot is moving forward at, you know, in the same direction. You're just sort of, like, rotating in certain pieces to change things. And yet, like, when I played, like, when that season, which is, you know, one of my favorites, like, I felt like I had my version of that story. Even when you go back, you realize, like, oh, like, actually there were only, like, there wasn't many other ways for this to play out. Like, there was just a way it plays out, and then you kind of shuffle a couple things along the way. But I thought what it was very successful at was selling the idea of player choice, but then also making them feel like you did have authorship over this, even if reality, and you looked underneath the hood. And maybe part of the reason it works is because actually they let you go underneath the hood, right? Like, Telltale Games are extremely transparent about the choice making, which Mass Effect was not. Like, that, a lot of that's happening just in the background. Maybe you see the consequences of it in an abstract sense, or you know, if a character lives and dies. But you finish an episode of a Telltale game, and it says, like, here are all the choices you made and the percentage of choices and how players interacted with it, which, by lifting the illusion, in some ways it empowers you more, because you know exactly where in what directions things went, because the game is saying these are the directions that you had agency over. And that most games don't do that. Most games try to hide that or abstract it away, whereas Telltale is the exact opposite, where it's like, nah, like 66% did this, and then only 10% did this, you asshole. And I think those are, like, really fascinating ways to approach, like, sort of player empowerment and how that plays into, you know, like, narrative fulfillment as you reach a conclusion, you know, relative to how much the player understands the input they had in the process.
Right, like, a thing I think about a lot is that Metal Gear Solid 5 story fucking sucks. It's terrible.
Well, I mean, you could. Did you hold on? You broke up. Did you say five? I think you just said Metal Gear Solid.
I said five. Mm. I said five because I think a lot of people think four wraps up nicely. I don't have strong feelings about that fucking series. They're games
one and
in
three,
it that I
baby.
Like a lot.
They're only ones that exist.
Two and five. Those are my two favorites.
I like five.
Is it like the Star Trek system, like of Star Trek movies, like either like the evens or the odds, like a.
I think it's similar.
It's more. It's with Metal Gear. It's do you in like. Not that three and one don't like play into the lore, but like they're standalone in a way that two and four are not.
Two and four are so mind fucky weird, like up their own asses. I like two a lot.
Dark Souls
I like
two,
how five
Metal
plays
Gear Solid
Dark Souls.
Two.
Yeah, 100%.
Super Mario Brothers
two.
Are you a Doki?
Listen, I love Doki Doki Panic. Like absolutely, that's what
Zelda
they call
two?
Me a Doki head for. I never played Zelda 2. I played Zelda 2 for like 3 hours. I owned it, and I just could never wrap my head around it as a little kid.
I was
kid.
The same way.
All right.
I wish I had. I bet I would have loved it. but Metal Gear Solid 5 is an instance, or even Metal Gear Solid 4, but I think most people came away from 4 feeling like it stuck the landing really well, but a lot of people played 5 and were like, man, this is a pretty good game. This is a fucking terrible way to end this series. but no one... And yet... There was not this outrage that was like, Kojima, before you leave Konami, fix this. Fix it. I mean, there were people who believed there was a secret seventh ending in that game.
Well, they dug up and found unfinished cutscenes, right? In
they
the game?
They did find, they found.
They found like an unfinished mission that like actually was related to the ending, right?
Well, and then that made them think that also there was a secret that was going to start playing under certain conditions.
Right.
If you looked in the sun the right way, it was ridiculous.
Or like the nuclear metagame that was going on. Like, oh, because actually there wasn't a secret cutscene that unlocked if you got
every player
to abandon nukes.
Disarm their nukes, there was a secret cutscene, 100%. But like part of that ended up feeling like the other stuff that happened with Mass Effect 3, which was the indoctrination theory. Response? Do y'all remember the indoctrination theory? None of it happened, Rob. Don't give me that look.
Yeah.
Sovereign, or it couldn't have been Sovereign because Sovereign was long out of the picture, but a Reaper indoctrinated Shepard, and none of that stuff happens at the end. And it was just like page after page after page about how like actually this ending is good because XYZ, because secretly it's not the ending at all. And I'm all for fan theories, but like my point is that sort of theorizing happened with Metal Gear Solid 5, but what didn't happen was like a letter writing campaign that forced Konami to release DLC to fix that story.
Because there's only 300
that actually
people
incomplete
who have
story.
Actually know
right,
the lore.
That's true.
No,
or who have gotten to hour 80 of that game.
I think that is something specific to do with people's relationship with Hideo Kojima not as an author, but as an auteur. Like you know, like he is
right.
He is given so much rope over like the shitty things that he does in his storytelling.
True.
Like I like a lot of the stuff.
Words and deeds.
Mm-hmm. That's a whole separate. Wow. How He Treats Women is a whole separate category.
It's not because I think it's the same thing.
So.
Of like,
oh, it is. It'll be explained. Like, there's
it'll
a narrative justification
a
for these titties.
Right. These titties have a reason behind them. God damn it! If you don't understand that, it's because you're too small brained to understand Kojima Sensei's brilliance. Right.
Only like Rick and Morty fans will understand.
Oh God.
Why Quiet has titty out?
Rob.
But like that is. But I guess my point, really quick, before is just like. For a long time, I'm a big person who pushes back against the auteur theory shit of like, and I think even Kojima does in that like, if you look at Metal Gear Solid 5, I've said this before, but every time you launch a mission, it says the name, it does say Kojima's name if he's involved in that mission, but it also says the name of the person who designed that given mission or who wrote the dialogue in that mission.
It's an audience and media thing. We have perpetuated the Kojima,
Totally. But so like, maybe I'll push back at myself a little bit, which is like, imagine if we treated more people in games like creators the way we do in other media forms. What if we did know then how many – the average person who goes to a GameStop and buys a game once a month, which is not rare, right? Which is like, hey, I get a paycheck. 50% of the time if I get paid biweekly, I'm going to go get a game. Even someone who buys 40 games a year or 50 games a year, how many people do they know in art teams? How many game directors do they know? How many names of producers do they know? 10? You know, 12, and some of those are like Sid Meier, which is like, you tell me the last time Sid Meier made a game. Because it's probably Starships, and I reviewed that before I was even at Giant Bomb. But like, I still know that name because it's a brand name. But we don't do that in this industry. We don't have, and because of that, because we think of these things as products that appear on shelves instead of like the creative work of a team or the creative work even of an auteur, whatever you want to, however you want to tackle that part of it, you people just say, no, change it, fix it. Hey, waiter, excuse me, Mass Effect, I asked for Mass Effect 3 to be well done, and this is definitely medium rare. Can you fix it? And
gross, the waiter, you don't get things well done. Who is this person?
Agreed. Oh. Donald Trump hates Mass Effect 3.
Oh, it tracks.
And that's the thing.
Yeah.
Is that like...
Wait, is this all an indoctrination? Like, did none of this happen? After November 6th, none of this is... None of this occurred?
That's what Robert Mueller is going to do. He's going to break us out of the indoctrination theory.
Oh.
How do you say indoctrination theory in Russian? That's what hashtag the resistance told me. Sovereign has compromat on Donald Trump.
Oh.
That was in the Leviathan DLC.
That was in the DLC.
It was under there.
My bigger point is just like, yo, we need to treat people who make games as people who make creative decisions and not just like a robot that spits out an order for you that can be recooked. And that's not saying things can't be wrong. Rob, sorry.
Well, and this ties into some of what we were talking about when we were talking about the ArenaNet situation, which is that I think in general among major publishers, but like especially among like publishers in like heavily represented in like English-speaking markets, right? Uh-huh. Like there is this... Again, like, power to the players. Like, we just, you know, we're here to serve you. Like, there's this dystopian quote from, I think it was Jade Raymond recently, talking about what her next project is. And she, you know, this was over at PC Games Then. The quote they sort of sign off with is her saying, one of the things we're really thinking about is, instead of a framework to hand off the keys to professional teams, can we design a framework where it can be handed off to the fans? Oh. And, like... That's, you know, I don't know what the full context of that quote, but I think the fact that that is something that, you know, a leading stakeholder feels free to say,
right,
is really revealing about how a lot of, you know, how publishers are starting to regard the relationship with players,
mm-hmm.
and how they are also conditioning players to regard their relationship with the works.
Right.
There's this weird, I think in a way, Kojima is kind of this, like his legacy of like the EGM era of like designers were, it wasn't just, you know, set aside auteur figures. Designers were like almost aspirational figures, right? Uh-huh. Particularly Japanese designers, right? Like there was a bit of you know, exoticization of the Japanese 100%. Games industry, but also there was just like linguistically and geographically a remoteness from their English speaking fans. It's why like Kamiya can just tell people like go fuck yourself, yep. and people are like, oh my goodness, Senpai noticed
me. He blocked me.
Yeah,
I made it.
And, like. People love that shit, and they will grant that respect. They will grant that enjoyment to, you know, Japanese designers of a certain generation, right? But they won't apply it to people making games today, like in Europe or the United States, right? There, it's hey. I ordered a happy ending for Mass Effect. Where the fuck is it? Like, that's kind of... That,
also die in a
that's
fire.
Another...
Yeah.
Right. But then also, like, where Kamiya can turn around and be like, you know what? Fuck off. The general strategy in, like, you know, Western markets is to turn around and be like, immediately must placate mm-hmm. the children, right? Like, okay, you know, we're listening to you, and we're just so struck by your passion. And
oh, the New York Times editorial board is here. I didn't know.
And we're going to give you the ending that you know that is
fans
worthy
deserve.
Of the fans and shit. Yeah, exactly. And I think that is this weird. This weird artifact of maybe not having enough regard for games as a creative field with people making like authoritative creative decisions for better or worse, that's their right, and it doesn't seem like that right is granted to a lot of teams and publishers these days. Publishers increasingly like deny that right exists.
Yeah.
Right. It's a tough thing because I do want to say that there is games are complicated for other reasons, which is like I'm glad that No Man's Sky is continuing to be patched until it's become a better game. I think that and even beyond the feature adds, it's important that certain like bugs get fixed. This is not a medium where right now, given the moment that we're in with, like, you know, patches and the internet, a game ships and that's it. It's done 100%. Like, there can be typos in visual novels and those are able to be fixed. You may as well fix them, right? I'm not saying that everything should just come out and that's it. You should never touch it again. But it is important, I think, as a creator to decide where you draw the line. As an editor, I know that like I'm happy to go back into a story and change something to make it factually correct. If we make a fuck up, if we say that a game is coming out on August 27th and it's actually coming out on August 22nd and we misheard it when we were in a busy room and we wrote the wrong one, yeah, fix it. Fix the thing, right? But if Rob says that, you know, I finally played Dark Souls 2 and it's the worst one and boy, is that bad. I'm never going to be like, Rob, go back in and change it. You have to say it's the good one. You have to. And I don't care how many fans say that Rob is wrong about that. Rob is right about that. For Rob, it was the worst one. For me, on the other hand, who understands the depth and nuance of the series.
I like how you put this on Rob, like, yep. As opposed to...
Because Rob hasn't played it already. I already know how you feel. And to quote Sean Murray, I don't care what you think, Patrick.
Wow. Wow.
I do think that this is like a thing that we're going to have to continue to return to and think about. And obviously, it does happen in other media. Like, there are director's cuts of films. There are, you know, how many versions of Wolves are out? How many did Kanye fix? Kanye fixed a lot of Wolves at this point. Danielle.
Yeah, there's something about this, though, that really, really reeks of, you know, the first decade of the 2000s, when I was in grad school, I was reading all about transmedia and how wonderful and how many possibilities there were for it because we could have conversations between creators and, you know, fans of a work or whatever. And there's this very sort of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed feeling about this ability to have conversations. And of course, you can go back. There's a lot of media theory that goes back and says that, no, people don't just watch something there. They are always in conversation with something. But this was literally with the advent of social media, people could be in conversation with creators. And this is going to be this wonderful thing that would help push mediums forward. It would help push everything forward because people could really be a part of this. Everybody could be a part of the whole thing. And it seems to me, and maybe this is just me being depressed in August of 2018, but it seems to me that there has been a massive disconnect between having a conversation between fans and creators and an angry mob running around with pitchforks setting the creators on fire. So again, I don't know how much of this is my own bias, but it really feels like the rhetoric is supposed to be this beautiful conversation, this beautiful creative collaborative process between creators and fans and fan creators and fan works and works of fan fiction and fan art and all this other good stuff. It just feels like that conversation isn't really happening. The biggest properties are owned by massive corporations who do shut those things down. And also, a lot of fans feel very entitled to go on hate campaigns towards creators. And it feels like there's a breakdown on both sides of that.
Right. I do think that stuff does happen sometimes. You look at something like Overwatch, which has huge amount of fan work that goes into maintaining the popularity of that game through fan art, through fan fiction, through fan comics, through a million and a half things, even just conversations on social media that fill in the gaps of that world and that universe. And of course, the fans who, you know, play competitively and who release YouTube videos and who stream so that even if I'm too tired to play the game, I can watch the game and keep it at the forefront of my mind. Like, corporations have gotten very good at capturing fan activity and fan labor, right? Like, yes, certain ones do shut it down. Like, when you're making a Metroid game, Nintendo's gonna be like, nah, don't do that, you know? And so there are obviously lines there, so I definitely see get your point there. But I do also think that there is a there is another dystopic world, which is like the one where the only fan work, the only fan response that's allowed is the one that is like, rah, rah, look at our fan art. Right. Rah, rah, look at my, look at how much this...
corporations are going to actually accept and highlight. So maybe we're in that dystopic vision.
Well, we're in the worst of worst, the worst of both, right? Which is like, we are getting the world in which the stuff that bubbles up is either hate mobs or like celebrationist. And the stuff that is like,
we hey, stuff in the middle.
Okay. Oh no, the woke gamer logged on.
They're not going to retract that National Reviewer. Like, that's forever. That's who you are now. But now, one thing that, you know, talking about this breakdown of fan relationships and sort of the corporate landscape, to a degree, is this exacerbated by the fact that all culture, media culture these days, takes place in this really restrictive world of intellectual property control.
Yeah.
Where, like, there is, like, something that makes it extra fraught is this knowledge that, like, once a series ends, once you know, a corporation is done with a trilogy or something, that's it. You're not going to see those characters again. The door is closed. The book is closed. What you don't have is, like, consider Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Right? That series 100%. Ends, like, he goes off to be a bee. Like, he fucks off. He's gonna go study the bee. Spoilers. That's what he's going to do.
Oh, hey.
And from there, people are free to do whatever the fuck they want with Sherlock
Thank
Holmes.
Thank God.
Including completely resituate him, recontextualize him, gender swap, whatever. It doesn't matter. Sherlock Holmes, whatever that means to you, you can make it, you can certainly make something better than Stephen Moffat did. Absolutely. But that's unusual because Holmes is one of the last, like, super popular, like, worldwide famous character, Mr. Worldwide.
Mr. Worldwide, like, a.k.a. Sherlock Holmes, right.
Before you start having these really aggressive IP regimes put in place so that...
Dale Watson. Sorry, God. Continue.
Yeah, so, like, I think it's... I think that's another thing that sort of intensifies this is that where people do, part of wanting control is also wanting to see your ideas reflected for the series.
Yep.
Art is inspiring. Like, it is impossible to, like, see a cool story or a new universe and not think, like, oh man, what would I do with that? But now you can't.
Right.
Only the company can.
This is now like a triple bind, right? Because on one hand, yes, I want to live in the world where Batman is Sherlock Holmes, which I can live in if I'm DC, because Sherlock Holmes is out of copyright, so I can just make Batman Sherlock Holmes. But I literally mean I want Batman to be as usable as Sherlock Holmes is, right? Think about all the amazing Batman stories there would be. Think about all the amazing Star Wars movies that people could make, or Star Wars comics people could make, if Star Wars would ever come out of copyright.
Well, Batman it won't and Elon happen. Musk are going right. to rescue our, yeah exactly
oh my
yeah.
god well I take it all back now get rid of it burn it
there,
all down
there is an exception to this though like so Valve is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, like in terms of like talking this the original beginning of this is like, you know, the lack of satisfaction or how
sure.
stories end, like
right.
the way the Half-Life series may or may not have ended through a writer like publishing a blog in which you basically just have to swap out some character names and you get resolution to an episode of Half-Life, you know, 2, episode 3 that people have been waiting, you know, more than a decade for. Like, that's a fascinating, like, once-in-a-lifetime sort of way for a story to come to a conclusion and to give closure to, or some form of closure to fans that have been seeking. That's what they, at a certain point, it's not that they even wanted a good game. They just wanted
they
to fucking know what happened at the end of a thing in which you made an explicit promise, like, that you were going to do this thing and you didn't. And then second, Valve, for I have all sorts of problems with Steam as a platform and
yep.
things that Valve does as a company, but one of the things that I like that they do is that they allow fans to create their own fan fiction for Portal, for Half-Life. Like, let's remember, like, there's a whole Half-Life remake, like, that they put up on their store and said, yo, just try and, you know, just charge money for it, like, do whatever you want. Like, they outright endorse and encourage fan fiction and for fans to profit off of that fan fiction, even in the instance of like a Half-Life remake, in which you would imagine for a normal company they'd be saying, yo, keep that in your back pocket, because what if we just like remake that game and make a bunch of money off it? And Valve said, essentially, they're like, well, if we're gonna do it, we would do it right, and like just go do it, you know what
yeah.
I mean, like, or just either, yeah. or they're indifferent, right? Like, if
right.
we're gonna go do it, we'll go do it, but you guys can go, you know, have fun doing it yourself. And not only that, like, crucially different than every other, I would say probably every other IP holder, like, you can make money off of it too.
Right.
And not only can you make money off of it, you can put it on our platform And the smart thing is, like, we'll make money off of you making money because we get a cut, right? And so there's a cynical way to look at that, but I think it is a net positive. It's part of the reason people are so passionate about Valve's storytelling, despite the fact that they have done so little to encourage it, is because they left the door open for fans to fill in those gaps and do it themselves. And rather than squashing that, they said, hey, actually come in and do it, make some money, and we're actually not only going to be okay with it, we're going to endorse it, which is a tacitly different approach than basically every other company out there.
So to continue that, though, like, the thing that I want to add is that while I absolutely am happy about that, and it's actually not a thing about Valve specifically, I'm happy that in that case fan creators can get paid and should be allowed to get paid, and I want that world to exist. I also want the world to exist in which creative work does not need to be understood only in terms of profit motive.
Yeah.
And that fan fiction and fan work, whether that's creating art or creating short stories or doing fan films, whatever that is, can be understood to be an end of itself, and where creativity of that sort is lauded after our, you know, early 20s, at which time many of us are told to, like, put the toys away and focus on your career, right? That, like, I don't know, outside of fandom, I don't know many people who write for fun the way they used to, right? Like, oh, I used to write stories in high school, and I stopped doing that because I couldn't get paid. And part of that reflects the modern condition in which the time that you have is either working or recovering so that you can go back to work and do your job.
Or taking care of family, et cetera, the whole
Totally.
Deal. Yeah.
But you can unpack all of this stuff around creative work, around the gendering of that sort of stuff. The gendering of hobbies is such a fucking thing. Into a point where there is a different world in which I stayed a trademark researcher and stopped writing, because even though I have in my head the best version of the Mass Effect ending, you know, I'm not going to write it. I'm not going to get paid for it. So even though I could write something that would make me feel really good, I'm not going to sit down and do that. And I wish we lived in a world that, one, yes, allowed people to just make the Mass Effect 3 ending that they dreamt of and sold it to people, and that would be really cool to see. But also one in which more people felt empowered to write their own stuff, to make their own fan works, and feel that that was satisfying. Not because you shouldn't care about the other people's work and that you should be satisfied by everything put in front of you, but simply because that is an avenue for resolution that is not often made available to us because the skills to work in those spaces aren't necessarily trained, and also because they're actually denigrated pretty openly, pretty much all the time. Like, this reads like fanfic is a fucking insult, and like, if you actually unpack it, like, this reads like something someone wrote because they were in a tight community and because it gave them some feelings of self-care and control. Like, oh, cool, dope, thanks,
yeah,
nice
what a
insult,
terrible
bro.
Thing. Right.
What a terrible thing. Yeah. So, like, that is my only complication of that is I want to live in a world in which fans can make stuff and get paid for it, and also the world in which they should feel free to make stuff just for them, and that needs to be okay. That's allowed to be okay and isn't denigrated.
Because they could feed their families just because.
Ideally, because we live in luxury space communism where all creative labor is in fact is something you do out of the joy of the work, right? But we don't live there yet, so pay your fucking artists.
There you go.
Really quick, the last thing I wanted to add on this is I actually just went back and read the actual announcement for the Mass Effect 3 Extended Cut, and the language in it is so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Through additional cinematic sequences and epilogue scenes, the Mass Effect 3 Extended Cut will give fans seeking further clarity to the ending of Mass Effect 3 deeper insights into how their personal journey concludes. I'm going to, like, jump around a little bit. This comes from Dr. Ray. He says, "We are all incredibly proud of Mass Effect 3 and the work done by Casey Hudson and his team. Since launch, we've had time to listen to the feedback from our most passionate fans, and we are responding. With the Mass Effect 3 Extended Cut, we think we've struck a good balance in delivering the answers the players are looking for while maintaining the team's artistic vision for the end of the story arc of the Mass Effect universe." Casey Hudson, executive producer of the Mass Effect series, added, "We have reprioritized our post-launch development efforts to provide fans who want more closure with even more context and clarity to the ending of a game in a way that will feel more personalized for each player."
How many personals and clarities? We're in there.
Lots of personal clarity, finally.
Draw no conclusions that I'm about to leave this fucking interface industry and the company I founded the minute I put this thing to bed. Signed, Dr. Ray.
Signed Dr. Ray. Got to get out of here. Got to go. Did Dr. Ray go and do the beer? Was Dr. Ray the beer one?
I think so.
I thought Dr. Ray was beer.
If I go to Google and type in the beer doctor, what's it going to get me?
Probably not Dr. Probably. Ray, but like if you put BioWare in there too, you're going to get Dr. Ray.
Anyway, I just think it's fascinating to look back at that specific use of language around passion, around even the way Casey kind of hedges a little bit. You can kind of there's a language there. There's a tone written into those words that is notable, I'd say. Ugh. Yeah, no, I typed in the beer doctor. None of this shit is Mass Effect.
No, you gotta get BioWare. Gotta get BioWare in there. I think.
Yeah, I thought Google was supposed to read my brain now or whatever.
Yeah, it's not perfect yet. Give that one 2 years. Don't worry, 2020. Read your brain and sells Dr. you
socks. Was Zeshuk about beer. Zeshuk was the beer.
Yeah, Dr. Greg is the beer doctor.
Oh, so Dr. Sorry, Ray Dr. Ray. What was he into? Just not beer, I guess.
Doctoring?
Being a doctor.
That's why they both had to leave.
Right, there was the split.
It's a hell of a career move, but you know, I don't blame anybody for that. I was going to
actually go ahead.
No. I was going to ask the one kind of question I've been mulling around in my head, and it's a simple one. Just as we've been having this conversation, it's not about bad endings that ruin something wonderful, because I think we all have a hundred of those. But if any of you have ever experienced something that actually genuinely in the ending or the ending arc of something actually recontextualized something for you and made it more interesting or more satisfying as a whole. And I'll broaden it out because I can't think of a game specifically, but I think I might have this with The Leftovers. But I know that's a fraught territory for
Let's
for
not
Patrick.
Go there.
Yeah, it's fine.
Patrick, you didn't like it? You didn't like the end of it?
No, I loved it. It's one of the greatest shows ever made.
Oh.
There's a great season and a great ending. All right, I'm sorry. I did it to me. I did it to myself.
I am literally a sucker. Like, look, you want to give me a good ending? Just circular structure. Like, doesn't even matter if it makes sense. Just at the end, have it wind back so that in some way, like, the theme repeats or is shown to have repeated in the past. Like, I mean, shit. Like, I remember, like, I don't know, like, I'm still not sure whether Herodotus really has a good ending to the saga of the Greeks and the Persians, because it ends with a completely nonsensical detour into a conversation that feels like we would have heard about when we first talked about King Cyrus.
Yeah,
but we totally didn't. And now suddenly he's like, you know what we shouldn't do is become an empire. We should just hang out here in the desert and remain free and poor. You know, that doesn't make sense, but like, it's a beautiful ending.
That's my favorite type of ending.
Give me that. Godfather 2.
Well, all of my favorites are the camera moves from the cycle or moves from the thing to some bullshit in the desert that is not connected in any way and is like a standalone parable. And often that's in essays, it's in academic essays, and often my favorites are the ones where they're being written in the 1930s, and it's the whole essay will be about thing A, and in the final five pages it's like, oh, this whole essay I've been writing is actually about fascism, isn't it? We should do something about that. And that nice. Comes up in fiction pretty often also, where you end up getting this like last second meditation on something in the rest of the fictional world as denouement. And I'm trying to think of something that pops into my mind for that. Or the other real problem is the endings that I love are for things that never finish. Top three TV endings of all time. Deadwood, Carnival, and
I haven't watched Carnival, but I've avoided it specifically because I've been told I'll just get angry at the end.
You'll get so angry, Patrick, you'll be furious.
So I'm just not gonna. Despite the fact that everything about that show sounds extremely
you would
my
love
shit.
Love Carnival,
right?
You would
I just
love
avoid.
It.
I watched the pilot and went, no more. And just just walked away.
It's really good. And Fastlane, a TV show that only I love. It is a Mick G joint. And
you've talked about Fastlane before.
I have.
Don't act like
ends,
you haven't brought this
gotta
up.
Put this one
it
in the
ends
show notes.
The worst possible way. It ends right in the middle of like someone's kidnapped. It's a whole thing. It's fantastic. And I like ending things in the middle. It's why I like the Sopranos ending, actually. It's also that. It's like, okay, this.
But that's intentional, right? Like, that's a creative choice.
But that's why I like to leave the
lack of closure. It's a response to the way endings are traditionally done.
100%. That's why
it doesn't have closure.
I think it has closure.
I think it has closure. Yeah,
I do too. But it depends on what you mean by closure.
Yeah. But that exact response is like why it's a successful ending.
Satisfying versus happy.
My favorite kinds of endings are the endings from horror films, because they always have to come up with a reason to make a sequel at the very end. Right. Where's the hand going to come out of the ground? Give it to me.
Speaking of that,
Open his eyes.
The end? Question mark. I just watched. It's not a waypoint or anything, but like it speaks directly to your point right here, Patrick. I just watched Nightmare on Elm Street for the first time in like 20 years, and that film, ending.
The original holds up really,
it's
really well.
Really good, and that ending is something. And the producer wanted one ending, the director wanted another ending, and they sort of weirdly compromised on like a bizarre art house ish kind of. Something or other. And of course, Freddy comes back.
You need to watch Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and then The New Nightmare. But those are the only three you need to watch. But they are 1, 3, and is it 8? I can't remember. The New Nightmare. The other one that Wes Craven only directed two of them. The first one, A New Nightmare.
All right.
And The New Nightmare is a horror classic. It is the pre-Scream film that he makes, in which he makes the pivot to making meta-horror commentary, and it's I'm still so angry that he followed me on Twitter and then he died. It's bad that he died, but I was just about to reach out and be like, yo, I've interviewed John Carpenter for a couple of years, we should chat, and then wah wah.
Well, that's the ultimate right here.
Your takes really are bad.
I feel like that was the ending of this episode. We just had the most satisfying, if not happy, ending. Right there on what happened to you, Patrick.
Thank you.
I was gonna do a question, but I feel like topping that.
Yeah, horror directors don't follow me on Twitter. It's a bad sign.
Jesus.
That's its own curse.
It follows in reverse. We're like, seem like some spicy tweets. Don't do it.
You too will be featured in the National Review.
Oh boy.
if you're lucky, the Daily Wire.
Did you get picked up in the Daily Wire too?
Well, I was sort of in the Daily Wire because they linked to the National Review article. So basically,
you got some runoff.
Ben Shapiro is writing about me, is what I'm saying.
Well, he did that tweet recently, right? Was that Shapiro who dragged you in a tweet?
No.
Or who retweeted you? Who was that?
I think I may have. Someone that quote tweeted me may have been.
No, it was not
no,
Peterson.
No, Cernovich was the one who.
Cernovich. Right.
It was Mike Cernovich. It was Mike Cernovich.
Yeah. One of the nice things about TweetDeck is that you can't see. Quote tweets, so I don't see a lot of that stuff.
Good.
Yeah, it's unbelievable that I can view Mike Cernovich and Ben Shapiro, because only one of those two people has the gorilla mindset, you know? Like, fuck.
Good. Very good.
Okay, we need to stop this
podcast. We should
get off this train.
That's probably
we
best.
Get off this train.
We need to find an ending for this podcast.
I don't...
In my mind, canon, it ended right there with your experience, Patrick.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
But this is the director's cut. Sorry, we heard you, fans. We heard that you didn't get the closure you needed from this episode.
Where's where's your Cernovich references?
We have to have Rob do a dramatic reading instead of something. I don't know what. Just
the end of his article. Give us the end of your article.
Of course.
That's how we'll end this podcast. But make it dramatic.
Make it real dramatic.
Make it dramatic.
Do you have it up?
No.
All right.
You could do it in a voice.
Just do a voice.
The people want it in a voice. I've talked to the people, and they said they want it in a voice.
So literally, you want me to read the end of my article again?
Yeah, the last paragraph.
Because that was so you're doing the circular structure.
Exactly.
But this time
I'm making you happy.
It's not even echo. It's just a literal circle.
Oh wait, was that what you read?
That
at the beginning?
Last graph. That was the last graph. I was like, I thought I read the ending. Did I forget where I put that paragraph?
Oh, then read the beginning. Read the first one then. And that's how we'll go
now
out.
It's art.
Now it's art.
Now it's
very
art.
Clever,
now
Austin.
It's art.
Very clever.
Art, but make it fashion.
In a way. I've been playing the Banner Saga for the last 4 years. Since 2014, I've been accompanying this small band of characters in their long odysseys through the end of the world, never quite knowing how all this was going to turn out, or who, if anyone, would make it out alive. I still think about some of the characters I lost from my own stupid decisions, though I must say I never lost anyone on the tactical battlefield, but instead at various inflection points in the game's visual novel narrative layer. I don't resent the game for this. It made those losses more painful and more shocking. One minute, everyone is alive and healthy, and the next, a friend and companion is lost to the most cruel and arbitrary death. It's not necessarily your fault, but it is your story, and you'll always wonder if maybe there was something you could have done differently.
Shout out to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine.
Questions good more gaming. About that. GamingAdvice.com.
.zone, BOEN, etc. Danielle.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. I just want to tell people that I'm doing Dead Cell streams every day.
Dead Cell streams.
Okay.
No hot mics.
What,
we got Dead Cells.
I can't do a fucking promo
you did one
here?
Today. You did one today that was supposed to be 30 minutes and was 2 hours because you're too good at the game.
What my favorite part of the stream was there were people legitimately upset in the chat. They were like, fuck, you're not supposed to get this far in your first run. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I was like, sorry. I had
Jeff
a really
Grubb.
Good tactical build.
Jeff Grubb fucking left the chat at one point after you beat a boss.
Patrick's just flying up there in the pro zone lair.
Oh, boy.
Right. Oh, Rob, you're ready for Evo, huh?
I'm hanging up.
Evo, Dead Cells. Yes.
Go read the article from Eric Van Allen about Dragon Ball FighterZ at Evo and who to follow there. Watch Patrick next week play some Dead Cells. I'm excited about that.
Hell yeah, Prozone. All right, we already did Bowen. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We're at twitch.tv/boypoint, and that's where you can watch Patrick all next week playing those Dead Cells. No more hot mics, more Dead Cells. Yeah, at least for the time being. All right, cool. Thank you, everyone, and I'm going to tell you to please...
It was all right cool in your script?
It wasn't. There was a noise coming from down below, and I was trying to max it.
Yeah, there's like a weird silence.
That one's
like,
not me.
There's a noise. It's the monster.
There's a noise from down below?
Yeah, like Cloverfield is starting in the back.
Oh, we didn't talk about Cloverfield.
I know. Shit. Part two. Don't worry, there's going to be a part two.
Cloverfield.
Part two. We'll have a part two at some point in life. Where can we find you online, Patrick?
At Patrick Club.
How about you, Rob?
At Rob Zachary.
How about you, Austin?
At Austin_Walker.
Amazing. You can find me at Danielle R.I. And before I get eaten by whatever monster coming from the void, it's coming from below, I ask you to please be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.